Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now, here's the show.
We've already seen, you know, these types of situations where government puts pressure on companies to take content down that can lead to really broad policies that sometimes take down speech that, you know, many people would want to be able to hear.
Who will be the arbiter of free speech and misinformation online? The Supreme Court weighs in. It's Monday, February 26th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, primary updates from South Carolina and Michigan, where some frustrated Democrats will vote for uncommitted instead of for President Biden. And if the recent headlines about in vitro fertilization have you worried about the future of fertility treatments, you're not alone. We'll talk to a patient and her doctor about what IVF is really like.
There are now about 2% of deliveries in the United States are from IVF. That's 80,000 babies a year, and that's only going to increase. And if clinics are shutting down, we already don't have enough services.
But first, the Supreme Court is considering arguments today in two cases that could change the future of the internet. And it comes at a time when many experts say our laws have not kept up with the pace of technological change. Those cases ask whether tech platforms like Facebook and YouTube can remove hate speech or misinformation. Kat Zakreski is a national technology policy reporter for The Washington Post. Here's her conversation with Peter O'Dowd.
These cases today are about a law in Texas that bars large tech companies from taking down certain kinds of posts, including hate speech, and a similar law in Florida. So let's hear now from Henry Whitaker, the Florida Solicitor General, who is defending the laws.
The platforms do not have a First Amendment right to apply their censorship policies in an inconsistent manner and to censor and deplatform certain users.
Okay, translate for us here. What is the argument that Whitaker and Texas and Florida are making?
So Texas and Florida are arguing that the tech companies are taking actions to discriminate against viewpoints they disagree with, and that that activity is not protected by the First Amendment. They basically argue that these companies are common carriers, much like a telegraph company, a phone company, or even a train company, that should be required to provide an essential public service and that they should be barred from any discrimination of users based on what their politics might be.
Mm. And what was the case, the original case, the details of it that got us here in the first place?
So these cases began basically as soon as the Florida and Texas legislatures passed these laws back in 2021 when the tech companies challenged them. But the Texas law briefly took effect for a little bit, and so we saw an example of how that might play out when there was a situation on Reddit. Basically, there's a Star Trek forum on Reddit, and one of the main rules to participate is that you have to be nice. But one user posted calling a popular character a soy boy. The moderators decided that violated the be nice rule and kicked them off. And then we saw that user use this new Texas law to sue Reddit and argue that they had been discriminated against because of their viewpoint.
I see. And here we are now at the Supreme Court today. Here's Paul Clement, who argued against Texas and Florida. Let's listen to his point of view.
Florida's effort to level the playing field and to fight the perceived bias of big tech violates the First Amendment several times over. It interferes with editorial discretion. It compels speech. It discriminates on the basis of content, speaker, and viewpoint.
Okay, so tell us more about the argument against these laws.
So the tech companies argue that they have a First Amendment right to decide what is displayed on their services. They argue that rather than the Telegraph or phone company framing that the states have, that they're more like a newspaper and they should be able to decide what views are on or off their services. And they also argue that this is a really essential defense against terrorism, misinformation, cyberbullying, and other terrible content because they have a market incentive to ensure that type of content isn't displayed on their sites.
Following the details of this case, I personally find can be challenging, but what it boils down to is the fact that most of us rely on the internet every day for almost everything. And if the court were to uphold these laws and rule in favor of Texas and Florida, could you lay out what the internet would look like?
So it's a bit unclear exactly what it would look like, but you could see a scenario where the tech companies take a far more hands-off approach to moderating their websites because they'd be afraid of getting hit with lawsuits from people who say they're discriminating. So certainly the tech companies have argued that if these laws were to stay in effect, at least in these states, when you were on social media, you'd likely see more misinformation about health issues, more terrorism, more harmful content related to children. Mm-hmm. And that could be very problematic. I mean, one of the interesting things we're seeing, though, is that the states are moving in different directions. So if these laws were allowed to take effect, we could be in a scenario where conservative states have one version of the internet that's more hands-off, and liberal states push forward with a version where there's more pressure on the companies to moderate content.
Could you imagine what kind of problems that would create?
Well, so we've already seen, you know, these types of situations where government puts pressure on companies to take content down. That can lead to really broad policies that sometimes take down speech that, you know, many people would want to be able to hear or see on the platforms. For instance, in Europe, there are hate speech laws that are sometimes very strict about talking about Nazis online. And that's intended to prevent hate speech, but it also can sometimes prevent discussion about news around extremism or issues in those countries.
I see. And just briefly, we have less than a minute here. Did you hear anything in court today that might give us any hints about how the justices are viewing these cases?
So I heard a lot of skepticism from the justices on both sides' arguments. It was interesting to see how some of the traditional ideological lines weren't necessarily aligned on this case. For instance, Justice Kavanaugh had a pretty tough round of questioning with the Florida Solicitor General, where he really raised the point that, you know, these states are arguing this is censorship, but censorship is something that the government does, not the companies.
Interesting. Kat Zakreski, reporter with The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Nikki Haley lost her home state by 20 points. But that's not stopping her campaign from selling it as a win against even lower expectations. After the break, Celeste Headlee checks in with a Republican political consultant on where the primary goes from here. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Leesa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.
Former President Trump called his win in Saturday's South Carolina primary historic after he won 60% of the vote. But rival Nikki Haley said this about her 40% of the vote.
He's not going to get the 40% if he is not willing to change and do something that acknowledges the 40%. And why should the 40% have to cave to him?
Haley spoke in Michigan, which holds its primary tomorrow. She lost a big financial backer yesterday, the super PAC funded by the Koch brothers, and Democrats, who also want to win Michigan, of course, joined her in condemning Trump's remarks on Friday that black voters can relate to him because he's been indicted so many times. Sharmackle Singleton is a Republican political strategist and former Trump appointee who has a show on Sirius XM. He resigned from the Trump administration because of Trump's incendiary rhetoric and temporarily left the Republican Party because of it as well. Sharmackle, welcome back.
Hi, Celeste. It's a pleasure to be with you guys. Thanks for having me.
We'll touch on Trump's remarks to black conservatives, but first, you agreed with others like the Wall Street Journal editorial board today that the 40% of the South Carolina vote is something Trump should worry about. Why do you say that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not enough to get 60% of the Republican electorate in certain swing states and expect to win. I'll tell you why. Donald Trump has to focus on a hyper battleground state strategy, similar to the strategy that yielded him the electoral success he found in 2016 against Hillary Clinton. Fast forward to 2020, a similar strategy projected President Biden to the White House. So you look at states like Georgia, where the former president lost by little over 12,000 votes, Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin. Again, two other states he lost by less than 20,000 votes. Wisconsin, he lost by around 33,000 votes. So you look at the math and you say, let's say the former president can get 60% of the Republican voters. That's not going to be enough based on the data from 2020 to recover from those very slim margins. If he can somehow get at least 15% of those individuals, then I think you have a further and even greater competitive race between the former president and the current president. Then you also have to factor in the potential that President Biden may potentially see a decrease in turnout from younger voters. There may be a decrease in turnout from African-American voters. So all of those things mathematically should be calculated. But again, electoral politics is always about addition, not subtraction. Right now, the former president really has to hyper-focus on adding more to his base.
Although, speaking of subtraction, a record number of Americans now say they are politically independent, neither Democrat nor Republican. And you have said and continue to say that wealthy white college-educated voters are leaving the Republican Party. Why?
They are. I think you have more affluent voters who are more educated, who are more principally concerned about the United States standing in the world and the Republican Party, individuals who probably would have been classified as more establishment, like they were more focused on tax breaks for wealthier entrepreneurs. There's a bit of disintegration, if you will, within the Republican Party from that class of Republican voter versus the more MAGA, less educated voters, more blue-collar workers. They really argue against sending money to Israel to a surprise. That's usually been a big thing for Republicans, generally speaking, right? Yeah. They don't want to send money necessarily to Ukraine. Again, another position for the Republican Party being against Putin and Russian aggression. You're seeing these new voters brought into the party more populist, more nationalist. They're very skeptical of immigration. And in part because these voters remember a moment in time in America's history where their place in society felt more secure. And so the idea of Make America Great Again, that slogan, I mean, I know we sort of laugh and chuckle at it. It doesn't really mean much. But for many of those voters, it means a lot. It means sort of a restitution of their standing, if you will, in the past. And more often what we find is that standing, that remembrance, really isn't in sync with more of the establishment view of the party, their view of what the role of the United States should be internationally. And so in many ways, just like the Democratic Party, You have disparate voters, and political leaders have to figure out a way to meet the needs and demands of each of those voters. For the first time, I would argue, ever, as the Republican Party has always, for the most part, been a very homogeneous party, we're now sort of teetering heterogeneous, if you will, but with two groups versus multiple groups like the Democratic side. And I think Republicans in the future are going to have to figure out a way in order to maintain the coalition, to keep the glue together, if you will. How do we speak to this new working class base, which represents a sizable percent of the party, while also regaining the suburbs again, regaining those sort of establishment-like voters?
So I don't chuckle about the Make America Great Again slogan, and that's partly because of remarks like those Trump made Friday to the Black Conservative Federation.
And then I got indicted a second time, and a third time, and a fourth time. And a lot of people said that that's why the Black people like me, because they have been hurt so badly and discriminated against. And they actually viewed me as I'm being discriminated.
So we have about 30 seconds left here, Shermichael. What do you make of comments like that?
It's not helpful. And I think it really plays to caricatures about African Americans, particularly Black men who are overrepresented in a criminal justice system. Donald Trump is a wealthy individual. He's still running for president. He has the money to hire a plethora of attorneys to fight all of these, 91 indictments. Most Black men can't do that. And so I think he would have been better off saying, we need a part two to criminal justice reform so that Black men can also have the same capabilities that I, as a rich person, have. And he didn't do that. It was
pretty
insulting.
We'll hold our breath till he says that. Shermichael Singleton is a Republican political strategist, former Trump appointee who has a show on SiriusXM. Thank you.
Thank you, Celeste.
Coming up, the reality of IVF in America before and after that ruling out of Alabama. That's after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
A recent court decision in Alabama ruled that under state law, frozen embryos can be considered extrauterine children. That has many patients worried about the future of in vitro fertilization, or IVF, which has become an increasingly common way for people with fertility issues to have kids, but which can also be a major strain on patients physically, financially, and emotionally. Belle Boggs knows that well. She underwent 5 years of fertility treatments, including IVF, in North Carolina, eventually giving birth to two healthy daughters, who are now 5 and 10 years old. She wrote a book about her experience called The Art of Waiting, on fertility, medicine, and motherhood. We also caught up with Belle's doctor, Stephen Young. He's an infertility specialist at Duke Fertility Center. The two of them joined Celeste for some straight talk about IVF.
So, Belle, you're not just personally familiar with IVF. I understand you also have friends and family going through it now. I wonder what you think is one thing that's misunderstood about this medical procedure, as many at this point are perhaps trying to think about the larger impacts.
I think probably most of your listeners, whether they know it or not, have a friend or family member or colleague who is going through IVF or considering IVF or saving up for IVF. IVF is emotionally and physically grueling. It's expensive. It does contain some inherent risk, but it's just such an important medical treatment. I think that's what so many people don't understand about it. It is a medical treatment for infertility, a medical treatment that is unfortunately not mandated to be covered by most insurance plans. I wish we were having a conversation about why IVF should be covered by insurance.
One thing that has come up, especially since this court decision in Alabama, is what happens if someone who is going through IVF decides to freeze their embryos. Now, you did this, although you ended up donating your remaining frozen embryos that you didn't use to someone else who needed them. What do you think people should know about that process?
Well, we were very lucky that our first round of IVF produced 7 embryos, and then we were able to freeze those embryos for a number of years. And so I'm very grateful, but I don't believe that if we were in a state that had a law like Alabama's recent law, that my husband and I, we would not have chosen to try IVF. We would not have been able to. We would not have been able to afford it.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Young, there are concerns, not just Bell's, but lots of patients have expressed concerns about embryo viability and how this ruling in Alabama could impact testing for that. Can you explain why testing genetically embryos before they're transferred into someone's body, why that's important to the health of the mother?
Well, maybe to give some background. Even during a natural conception in a younger woman, only about a quarter of the eggs that are fertilized, you know, they call those embryos, will make a baby. And that's about what it is for IVF in young women, say, under 35 years old. In women over 40, it's like 1 in 20 fertilized eggs will make a child. Mm. And so it requires freezing just to do that testing. And you should know also that that testing can be done when a couple carries genetic diseases that can be deadly to the baby.
And you know, some of this testing has to be done to lower the risk for miscarriage. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So chromosomally abnormal embryos often don't implant, but those that do are most often lost to miscarriage.
Because IVF is in the headlines now, a lot of people are trying to understand this procedure. I wonder, Dr. Young, for those who don't have any experience with this in their families, what kind of information do you think might be helpful?
Well, I'm sure Bell can speak a lot more eloquently about the stresses, but I can give you the sort of a background. So it takes about 8 to 12 days of hormonal injections, and these are multiple injections a day, to cause the ovary to mature, you know, more than the one egg or two eggs. And then when the time is right, under anesthesia, those eggs are removed using a needle, and those eggs are placed in an embryo lab. And then they are inseminated with the partner's sperm, or in some cases donor sperm. And then they're grown in the lab for about somewhere between 3 and 7 days. And once those are at that stage, they can be frozen, they can be transferred back to the uterus, and we can also test them at that phase. And those that if they're undergoing testing, then we will freeze them all. If they are not undergoing testing, then we might transfer one, or we might freeze them all for other reasons of safety. You know, women that are about to undergo cancer treatment that might eliminate their chances of conceiving afterward may freeze embryos and to ensure, you know, their ability to have a family. And then, of course, you know, sometimes soldiers or other people get injured and they can no longer conceive naturally. And again, they may freeze embryos if they are not, you know, at that point able to have children.
I wonder, Bell, what are you concerned about, especially in light of this ruling that we've been referencing? What worries you about the future of IVF?
Well, as Dr. Young was explaining, there are so many steps. You know, these steps are very expensive. It was, IVF remains unaffordable for many people who would like to have it as an option for building their families, for overcoming infertility. But I think additionally, the idea that someone post-Dobbs who doesn't know, I am imagining, does not know, and reading the opinion, it feels, does not know very much about the science and the heartbreak of infertility too, that these people are making decisions and coming between a patient and their doctor. I never considered those embryos in their vials. I never considered them a child. I've spoken to so many women and couples and individuals experiencing IVF treatment, and I've never spoken to someone who used the phrase extrauterine child or cryogenic nursery, because to do this, you know something about the process, and you hopefully know something about the science.
You've mentioned a few times the cost of IVF, and it can be up to $30,000 for one cycle. So, Dr. Young, I wonder what you're worried about, especially as a physician who specializes in infertility. Are you concerned about a ruling that eventually could affect you?
Hugely. Already a few clinics in Alabama have shut down doing IVF procedures. This is affecting all those patients who spent their time and emotional investment and money in trying to conceive a family. It's just devastating for them. And they shut down because fear of legal prosecution just for helping people have babies with IVF. I mean, there are now about 2% of deliveries in the United States are from IVF. That's 80,000 babies a year, and that's only going to increase. And if clinics are shutting down, we already don't have enough services. One of the reasons that, if you look geographically, there are parts of the country where people don't have easy access to a clinic, and it's going to get only worse if other states follow suit. One of the things that just is really impactful on this is that there are good reasons to think we could make IVF simpler, better, and lower cost. But the Dickey, Wicker, and Hyde amendments block federal funding for IVF research because of concerns over status of the embryo and abortion and such.
Dr. Stephen Young is an infertility specialist at Duke Fertility Center, and he was the doctor for Bell Boggs, former IVF patient in North Carolina, and author of The Art of Waiting on Fertility, Medicine, and Motherhood. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
That's our show. It comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Jill Ryan, Lynn Manigan, and Ashley Locke. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Micaela Rodriguez, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carleen Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on every purchase. Plus, earn unlimited 5x miles on hotels and rental cars booked through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
In this country, more than 2 local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.